Welcome. I'm glad that you were able to come to what was billed as a sale for discounted religion. And we'll actually, I don't think that's what we're up to, is giving you religion on the cheap. But we are here as part of the Difficult Dialogues Forum to talk about consumerism and capitalism and how they're appraised by various religious traditions. Well, let me introduce folks who are going to be on, who are on the panel today and or tonight. We're here. Art Gish, how about I just say introduce you by name, and you say a word or two about yourself. We're not too long, but tell us who you are.
I'm a local farmer, sell organic vegetables at the farmer's market, and a peace activist.
And Howard Resnick.
I've been I guess you could say, a serious practitioner of bhakti yoga, sort of the theistic spiritual yoga from India for about, well, almost 40 years. Did my academic work at the University of California, where I'm from, and Harvard, and I teach at the University of Florida. And I took a wrong turn and ended up here somewhere.
That was a right turn. That was a
right
turn. And Tom Erlingwine?
I'm here representing the Athens KTC, which is a Tibetan Buddhist organization we've been going for about 4 years in town. I'm the director of that group, and so representing whatever ideas I can come up with from the Buddhist point of view.
And Heather Irwin.
I'm a graduate student here at OU in International Studies, and am myself a practitioner of Islam. And that is about all I think you need to know about me.
Thank you. Well, consumerism, I mean, religious people, I think, in general, are concerned about consumerism, I would assume for a couple of reasons. One is that consumerism, whether at the conscious level or the subconscious, suggests to us in our practice that if we really want to be happy, we need a few more things. And so there's that sense that religious people tend to think of as being false notion that more things will necessarily make our lives more fulfilled. That's one problem that I might see with it. And then another problem would be that as people become acquisitive, they're liable to, if the goal is to get more and more, I'm likely to neglect my neighbor, even if my neighbor ends up getting less and less. So those are a couple of problems, but let me ask quickly, whether there are other problems about consumerism that you'd like to mention, that you think we should put our eyes on.
You guys?
Or anyone in the audience? Is that pretty much what I'm saying?
Are we allowed to get ideological? It depends on how you see the legitimate purpose of people assembling together to live in societies. Like, what is the origin and what is the justification for social contracts and so on? What justifies moral principles and so on? What are the real purposes of societal living? And so I think one thing that bothers me is that consumerism, I think, fundamentally misdefines our relationship with nature. And it also fundamentally contradicts in some ways, the metaphysical assumptions which are the basis of our political system. I think one of the greatest, one of the most amazing contradictions, which no one seems to notice, of our historical age is secular democracy. Because if you look at the Declaration of Independence, you find that our political system is based on a religious assumption, which is put there by Jefferson, namely that we are created equal, not evolved equal, not just happen to be, because we're all physiologically human, we all have equal rights. But our rights are actually directly traced to a metaphysical assumption, which is that we were created and created equal, and in the eyes of the Creator we are equal. Therefore our rights are inalienable, which means that no earthly power can take them away from us, such as the King of England, that was Jefferson's point, because they come from the highest possible authority. So we have a political system based upon a metaphysical, and I would say a religious assumption, which is sort of the goose that gave the golden egg of equality. And this gets back into a whole historical analysis of where the very notion of equality came from in Western civilization. And so if we... One last thing, I know I'm going over time. And that is, if you look at the journal which was kept by Captain Winthrop, who led the Massachusetts Bay Colony, the first people that came over to the Mayflower were just kind of like the advance party to cut some trees down and, I guess, you know, remove some indigenous people. And then the actual colony came in the second wave, and the Captain Winthrop in his journal predicted that America would be like a city on a hill, that in a sense the formation of America as a country was the formation of a new covenant with God. And this is certainly reflected a bit in the language of the Declaration of Independence. So to see nature as simply out there to get your hands on, to exploit, is, I think, fundamentally redefines and misdefines our natural relationship with nature. And so it gets into all kinds of serious spiritual issues, which then produce other symptoms, such as political, social problems, and so on.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, let me tell you what I want us to do, what the organization of the presentation will be. We've sort of got the problem in front of us, what we think might be the problems. And then I'd like us to begin to bring whatever wisdom we can bring from our religious traditions. Now, we're of different experience, and you know, some people are academically trained in their religion, others aren't. That is, our traditions affect people in ways that are academically precise, and sometimes just by ripple effects. That's what most traditions affect people. You just kind of grow up soaking up some of the stuff. So we're going to, however much we know about our tradition or however much it's affected us, we're going to draw on that to try to analyze this situation. And the first thing I want to do is to start to sort of keep the discussion as honest as we can in our own minds, is to ask, what has our own tradition, how effective has our own tradition been in dealing with problems of consumerism and the false values that we may see in consumerism, if our tradition has been really successful, then that's an important thing to know. If it hasn't, then it's also important to acknowledge that rather than to launch into a bunch of kind of pleasant pieties about our tradition if it's not done a good job. Then after a while, we'll move on to what are the, you know, despite the, however our religious tradition has done historically, are there elements in our tradition that seem to provide guidance that we look to for maybe pointing a better way for us and our families? And then the third thing where I really want to spend most of the time is, what can we do then? Are there practical things that we can do? And I'll ask each of the members of the panel to suggest at least one thing, and we'll go through them one by one. And also, I'd like you to be thinking about whether there are practical things that you can think of that would affect maybe your family. How do you deal with the problem of consumerism and false values at the family level, or at the smaller community level, the national level, the international level, anything? You know, what are your suggestions? Okay? So, now, for these, especially for the first two questions, I'm going to set a 3-minute timer so we don't go on and on. I probably already have. So the first question is, how has your tradition done on this matter? Whichever one of you can start, or I'll pick somebody.
I'll go last.
No, I'll start it. Or just one.
Let her rip hard.
All right. I want to start by thanking whoever set this up. I'm deeply impressed with this. Most people don't want to talk about difficult issues. And you're suggesting that we...
Is the sound coming through back there well?
Okay.
I'm sorry. I just want to make sure.
And you're doing it from an interfaith perspective. That makes, I think, the discussion doubly important. It's really important we break down stereotypes. I think it's significant there's only one woman on this panel, and she represents Islam. How about that for breaking down stereotypes? I also want to say that I'm really uncomfortable being here. I'm very uncomfortable being in this building. This despicable, opulent, wasteful building that consumes huge amounts of energy. That escalator runs 24 hours a day, and as a protest, I refuse to go on it. I use, you know, the stairs on the chair? Mm-hmm. Is exercise, that's a good thing? Okay. Now, I've been asked to represent Christianity and Judaism, and let me just say, I was raised Christian. I consider myself fully Christian, but I also identify myself as a Muslim, and I identify with the Jewish faith. I go every week to the mosque and the synagogue here in Athens in addition to Christian. But I can't represent them. I really cannot this evening represent Christianity. I am not from mainline church. I come from the Church of the Brethren, one of the three peace churches, pacifist churches. While most churches have endorsed war, you've all heard of the religious right. I come from the religious left, unashamedly. Now, Christianity, for the most part, has adopted and baptized capitalism, just as it's baptized war and empire. I think that capitalism is a complete contradiction of the Christian faith. And as a Christian, I cannot support capitalism. Regarding the Jewish tradition, it's very mixed. Jews are thought of as capitalists, but in the last century, a disproportionate percentage of Jews were identified themselves either as socialists or communists. So you find both in the Jewish tradition.
Thank you. Heather?
Sure. Well, in considering the first question about how well Islam has addressed the issue of consumerism, I have found it rather difficult to answer that question, largely because we're talking about a very large group of people in very different economic situations and different cultural situations. So trying to take all of that and summarize it down into this little essence of have people within Islam broken free of consumerism is not something I think can really be answered. I think that Islam, like all other faith traditions that I've observed, have some people who are more aware of how they live and are more interested in living simpler lives, more in the style of the Muslims who didn't have all that much, to make the choice to not buy extravagantly. And there are those who don't. I think this is the same the world over. There is, however, an internal dialogue that I've seen going on about what is acceptable enjoyment of life and what is not. One imam that I heard recently shared in a lecture that a young woman had come to him and said, you know, I've got these 40 jilbabs. Do you think that's too many? A jilbab is like an outer dress. And so she's honestly wondering, Do I have too many clothes here? And so the imam suggested that, well, maybe she'd think about giving a few away. Not that it's bad to have pretty things, nice things, but at a certain point, you just have to think about it. And so that's something I've seen really starting to happen within Islam. As far as what principles within the religion really address this question, there are numerous examples, and I don't have time to give you even a portion of them. But I'll give you some basic idea. Essentially, the enjoyment of life for Muslims is not sinful. It's forbidden to be an ascetic. Balance is encouraged. You're supposed to enjoy the life that God gave you, but remember that it's God that gave you the life, and it's God who provides for you, sustains, creates everything around you every moment, and that if you lose sight of that, then you start falling into the trap of temptation, consumerism, greed, and so forth. We're also reminded that we are responsible for taking care of those who don't have as much as we do. So if a person who has more than they need remembers this, then they will feel this responsibility and this lack of attachment to what they have as opposed to someone who doesn't remember this. essentially the world's appropriation for the life to come, which I think will be echoed by some of the other faith traditions, and possibly not by others. But for Muslims, this is the basic idea. So those who keep this point of view primary are less likely to fall into the trap of things equal happiness. But as we all know, this doesn't necessarily happen so well. And later we can address how that might be rectified.
Thank you. Who's next? Tom.
The question is, how well has Buddhism done in helping us, or any of these religions helping us, be free of commercialism? I have no idea. I know that for me, I was raised a Christian and found myself to be a Buddhist later in life. My idea of a religion or a path is, I mean, a little corny metaphor, you could say, well, there's a light on a hill I'm following, and we've all got a light up there that we're following, and whether we're following it or not doesn't really reflect on how good a job that light is doing of showing the way to go. And most of the people I know are not following it particularly well. I'm certainly not. I mean, just struggling with it every day. The things that I think Buddhism talks about related to consumerism would be the attempt to be without attachments. There's no judgment. There's no deity to say that was a bad thing to spend your time on. But there is cause and effect as a basic rule, in that if you spend your time trying to pursue these things that are just going to rot and fall away, that is time that you could have spent building your own practice, that you could have spent in a better way. There isn't anything that you can get. My favorite example right now is an iPhone, because I wish I had an iPhone. And it's just an absurdity. I mean, so there's this little shiny thing that I kind of wish I have. And if I get myself an iPhone, I'm not going to be better off at that point. That's not the way that it works. It's the whole fascination with it that is a fascination with myself that keeps me from thinking of others. And what Buddhism would like us to do is, at least particularly the branch of Buddhism that I'm in, is keep your focus on helping others. That's the first thing that you're supposed to do. I think that's sort of contrary to consumerism.
Try to squeeze a lot in. Hey, in the Bhagavad Gita, the main text of the Indian Hindu Vedic tradition, there's a beautiful verse that says, well, the Sanskrit, evam pravartitam chakram, that a wheel has been made to turn, and that one who does not keep this wheel turning lives in vain. The wheel, or the cycle, chakra, is that we are receiving so many gifts. I mean, the rain and the sunshine, food, land, everything, and that we have to offer back. It's like pay our cosmic utilities. And that in general, as living beings, as souls, we receive gifts, we offer back and sacrifice, we receive more gifts, we offer back more. And so Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, one who does not keep this wheel turning actually lives in vain, and is sort of like breaking the fundamental law of the universe, that you have to receive and give back. So, and then Krishna also says that anyone that does not live in this spirit of giving back, receiving gifts and giving back, their life is simply what's called, of course, called in India karma. In other words, the universe does react to us. Everything we do produces sort of a Newtonian, you know, equal and opposite reaction. That's the law of karma. So the universe is, you could think of it as this gigantic sensitivity training device, where everything we do comes back to us and we gradually learn virtue. Now, as far as what specifically the Hindu or Indian, Hindu is really a modern word, but this ancient Vedic tradition, what it has to offer, I think, is something that you find also in Plato and his Republic. You find it probably the oldest book in the Indo-European language, the Rig Veda, and that is an organic metaphor or an organic analogy for society. Society is like a living body. And there's a head on the body. The idea is that different members of society have their different services to perform. The stomach feeds us, in a sense, and the arms defend us, unless you're a kickboxer, I guess, but your arms and legs and the mind, your intelligence, your brain guides you. So the idea is that society needs a brain. This is Plato's conclusion in the Republic. And I think the reason we don't have a brain at the present time in our society and why things are going out of control, I'd like to put it in historical context. This is not the first time in history there's been a problem with consumerism. And so if we look at a historical context, we can see patterns. Under what historical conditions do people become very materialistic? And basically what I'd like to say, I'd like to look at history dialectically, as Hegel did. in the sense that if you look at the relationship between spiritual religious traditions, say in Europe, and science or materialism or an interest in the material world, originally in the Renaissance, the Catholic Church, well, it was the only church in Europe at that time, at least in Western Europe, most of Europe, the church was actually one of the greatest patrons of the Renaissance. There was the idea of reason, philosophy, and so you had this very nice marriage between religion and science and philosophy. Then they became estranged. There's no time for the whole history of the Protestant Reformation, Luther's idea, sola scriptura, scripture alone, that science, we don't need science, we don't need the material world, all we need is the Bible. And eventually there was a divorce. This led the Catholic Church to respond in kind. You got the trial of Galileo. So from being one of the great patrons of the Renaissance, they put, and of course our picture of Galileo's trial is sort of a cartoon version we have in the West, but still the idea is there was a divorce between religion and science, and religion was on top. Then of course we had the scientific revolution, the age of reason, and eventually science ended up on top, and religion became, in a sense, was kicked out of the universities, just as the universities had once kicked out science. Actually, they were still teaching Aristotelian astronomy in European universities long after Newton. And so then the universities kicked religion out of the universities, and science and materialism, humanism took over. So my point is that in order to have a healthy society, there has to be intellectual, spiritual leadership. There has to be a brain which is enlightened. And this divorce between so-called intellectuality or science and religion, spirituality, is leaving us with, in many cases, sort of like an ignorant, fanatical religious culture. These are very crude generalizations, but there's some truth in them. We have, to some extent, sort of an ignorant, fanatical religious culture and sort of a spiritually bankrupt intellectual tradition. So, in dialectical terms, I think the synthesis is we have to move forward beyond religious fanaticism. You know, we're not going back to the Middle Ages, I hope. A religious fanaticism, not having a spiritually empty humanistic intellectualism, which also has led to great things like the Bolshevik Revolution, which was sort of the culmination of the Western philosophical tradition, in a sense. And what we need is the synthesis, which is a spiritually enlightened intellectualism, so that we can actually deal with people. Because people in general need spirituality, and the World Wildlife Foundation actually did a study to find out what motivates people to make significant changes in their life, because you can bury people alive in data and they still are kind of selfish. And they found out, oh God, I'm out, that's a knockout. Last sentence, this will be one last 79 word sentence. The WWF, the World Wildlife Foundation, actually found that it was some kind of spiritual conviction that led people to make significant changes in their life. The same data, when I was at Harvard, they had a conference discussed data that came in, which says in inner city, you know, ghettos and things like that, the one diagnostic factor which led people out of antisocial type of lifestyles was church attendance. And the Declaration of Independence, I already mentioned, the rooting of our basic rights and dignity in a metaphysical fact. And as Hume pointed out, this is really the end. As Hume pointed out, you can't really derive a metaphysical fact from a physical fact. And so because we're anatomically human, you can't prove we have rights. It actually comes from a metaphysical reality which Jefferson understood. So,
thank you.
Yes.
Well, as a moderator, I don't know if I'm supposed to say anything or not, but I will. Let me set the timer. And I'll stick to 3 minutes. From the time I was a kid, I loved God and wanted what was good. And I thought for a long time as I was a child that I'd found that in my particular little niche of the Christian tradition. There have been times that I have felt much betrayed by that tradition, as though you go to a well and find that it doesn't have the good water in it that it's supposed to have. And on this issue of I don't know, consumerism is really another word for a kind of greed, I suppose, right? On this matter of acquisitiveness or greed, I have found that my own tradition has talked a reasonably good line sometimes, but in fact has really not done much. I noticed that even as a young child, about Christmas of all things, you know, this was a time when we were supposed to be particularly attached to God, and I found that instead it was a time that I was encouraged to be particularly attached to presents and to make sure that I found presents for someone else and stuff. And as the years have gone on, I found that I try to get out of this kind of spider web of greed and acquisitiveness, but it's not an easy thing to do, and I can't claim that I've been very successful at it. On this building, I was actually on a committee that contemplated whether to build this building, and I'll tell you, Art, that I fought it tooth and nail and got very obscene about it with certain vice presidents who aren't here anymore. And was told, I mean, I got obscene when the declaration was made, the university anymore simply cannot attract students without one of these fantastic mega mall student centers, and you just can't do it anymore. And I went nuts. I said, all it takes is one counterexample to disprove that assertion, and as it happens, we're meeting in the old Baker Center, which is a dump. And look, we're doing well, and our enrollments are increasing, and we're doing a good job of teaching students, and so on. But nonetheless, I think you're right to say that this building is itself an example of an enthusiasm that doesn't calculate real purposes. Okay. Well, how about, some of you have already commented about the resources, sort of thoughts that you find within your tradition that you think help us to tease out and under those of us who find ourselves caught up in this problem of greed, consumerism, acquisitiveness. Well, take a few minutes, like three, and comment on these resources that you'd call to our attention that you think we ought to remember in our society. You want to go in the same order we did? That'll make it easy. You don't have to fight that way.
All right.
Break out of the problem.
Let's start talking about the Bible. The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. Whatever we're talking about, it belongs to God. The Jewish scriptures are very clear. The land belongs to God, not to us. Private ownership of land, I believe, is contradicted by the Jewish scriptures, which Christians say they accept. Both the Bible and the Quran forbid the charging of interest. How's that for a contradiction of capitalism? Let's talk about Jesus. Jesus said, "Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth." If anybody doesn't understand that, they'll come to me afterward and I'll explain what "do not" means. Jesus is recorded in the New Testament as having mentioned the subject of money and economics more often than any other subject. And yet what he said is hardly ever mentioned because it's too radical. Can I just talk plainly? Jesus was a communist. He rejected the idea of private property. Okay, enough of that. My wife, Peggy, and I graduated the same year from college. We got married after our sophomore year. All of our friends, after graduation, bought new cars and furniture and all kinds of stuff and went into debt. We lived very simply and put ourselves through and decided that we were happy and didn't want to change. And we didn't. He said, "Well, wait till you have children. Wait till this, wait till that." Well, we're in our upper 60s now and we still haven't changed. We love our freedom and we're not willing to give it up for stuff. And so we live very simply because we want to be free. We have tremendous freedom. We spend much of our time in the Middle East with Christian peacemaker teams because we don't have to be spending that time making money. We do it because we care for God's creation. To consume more than my fair share of the resources of the world is theft. Shouldn't do it. We deliberately keep our income each year below the taxable level because we do not want to pay more taxes. I mean, how can I pay for war and say I oppose war? And the way we do it is we keep our income below the taxable level. Both to not pay for war, and we believe that nobody should live above that level, because the earth simply can't sustain a lifestyle above that level. And then one final quick comment. We have always felt called to live in community. And the answer is community. And you look at the Bible, the early Christians followed Jesus' teachings. They pulled all their resources and lived a Christian communal life.
Thank you.
Take it.
Well, I'm going to speak a little more personally than I did the first time. One thing I did not tell you in my introduction is that I am also a small business owner. I have a website that sells headscarves and other kinds of things like that to Muslim women, mostly in the U.S. I have some customers in Canada and every so often one in Europe. And that's been a very interesting place of struggle with me in thinking about these issues of materialism and greed and so forth. Because honestly, Muslim women are like any other women. They like to have lots of clothes. They like to look good. It's pretty typical. So in my business, I've had to really think hard about what I sell and also how I advertise what I sell so as not to fall into the trap of promoting fashion hijab or fashion dressing like this. Because if one is trying to follow fashion, regardless of whether one wears a headscarf or a miniskirt, it still involves the acquiring of more and more clothing and more stuff in order to go with the fashion and to be fashionable and to keep up with fashion and so forth. And I don't want to encourage that. So trying to figure out how to provide for what Muslim women feel that they genuinely need without promoting that sense of I have to have this, that, and the other thing can be kind of difficult sometimes. And I realize that this means that I won't sell as much. My business is probably never going to be particularly huge because I don't encourage this kind of buying. But at the same time, at the risk of sounding overly pious, I have to stand before God with a clear heart. And I feel that's the only way I can do it. So that's my struggle. And you?
Well, I think that I've always, since I've been here in Athens and I've met Artin, thought that Artin is a pretty unique example of following his faith and living it out. Some of the images that I've seen, some of the stories that I've heard, some of the things that I know. I don't consider myself to be that kind of on-the-edge representative. It's a struggle for me. I'm just sort of a regular Joe in a lot of ways. I think that the commercialism, the greed is the right word, Steve. That's what we're talking about. Is really, in my personal view, it's really supported by television, has been for as long as television's been around, and the tendency for all of us to sit at home alone and think about others being, capital O, others out there that we're separate from, keeping tabs on through the news media, thinking about, worrying about, but not talking to and not meeting. And so, in my Tibetan Buddhist tradition that I'm following, we're encouraged to meditate regularly. We're encouraged to try to still the mind and get separate from these vibes that come through the television. Just like, oh, like right now, let's get another one, and that one's a little old, isn't it? Let's get the next. I think that the best thing that I've found is the idea of Sangha. And I think Steve might have been that mentioned, and Art has, I mean, the idea of going to church, I think that's a great idea. Now, it's not a church that I go to, it's a meditation group, and the idea of getting together with a community and spending time together face-to-face, that's really helpful. And then if you're doing that frequently, then as you are just living life day by day, you get that constant reminder of other people who are trying to struggle with the same things. It's a whole lot better than sitting home alone reading the newspaper and watching TV. So I think maybe the best thing that I can think of to do is what this is tonight, is try to get people face-to-face and talking. And the promise of this evening is that it isn't about a panel. It's not a broadcast. It's a dialogue. So I hope we can shift to that mode. Mm-hmm.
I have to say I admire very much the way Art has lived his life, and I'd like to mention just a few things. He mentioned that in the Bible, I think, and perhaps in the Quran, the idea that the land belongs to God. But we have to put that in historical perspective. That was within a society that had divine right monarchy much of the time. So if you say the land belongs to God and the king is God's representative, then, well, you can connect the dots. Then one other point I want to mention about Jesus being a communist and communal and so on, which he was, but if we look at the history of religions, what we find is that many religions, including Buddhism, certain Hindu groups, certainly the early Jesus movement and so on, you could talk about the Essenes, who wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls and so on, that there's a certain phase in the social development of a religious community where they tend to be communal and pool their resources and so on. You find this also with St. Francis and his early community. But as communities grow, as they spread out into society, it's very hard to keep this communal spirit. So, again, I'm not saying what should be. It would be great if it was like that. I want to talk about the real world. I think in the real world, people in general are pleasure-seeking. And unless they have a higher pleasure, unless they have a higher taste, they will go for the gusto wherever they can get their hands on it. And unless systematically the wise people of society, if there aren't any wise people in society, we're in serious trouble, but assuming there are wise people in society, if people cannot be guided to have a higher taste, a greater pleasure in the spiritual, they will go for the material. That's just the real world. And so I think, again, getting back to this historical dialectic, what's really needed is a wisdom. I mean, morality, or you could say the restraint, of, to use Plato's word, of our appetites. I mean, we have this tendency to grab things, enjoy them, to fight off other people, and, you know, it's for my family or my country or my community or whatever, my religion. And so this is restrained by higher understanding. People have to cultivate virtue. But the cultivation of virtue tends not to come from rationalistic, humanistic, social contractarian traditions, as actually many academics don't realize. But actually, history shows that the cultivation of virtue tends to be inspired by spiritual traditions. And when you divorce the spiritual from the intellectual, society becomes headless, basically. For example, the quintessential town hall democracy is Athenian democracy under Pericles around the approximately 2,400 years ago. The reason the Athenians had such fantastic town hall, participatory, everyone up to the Parthenon democracy is because Athenian citizens had so many slaves at home. And so they had plenty of time for political committee meetings because they had slaves to harvest the crops, slaves to wash the dishes, slaves to do this, slaves to do that. So if you have a lot of slaves, you have plenty of time for participatory democracy. What I mean to say is, despite the Renaissance trying to get back to the greatness of Greece and Rome, the Greeks and Romans had no real notion of equality. It was actually came from Jesus when Christianity came into Western civilization. So in a highly secular, almost intellectually hostile atmosphere, academically hostile to old-time religion, I think it's practically impossible to motivate large numbers of people to make significant changes in their lives in the cultivation of virtue. We need to reunite intellectuality, academics, and the spiritual at a systemic societal level.
I'd mention just one thing from a saying of Jesus that I just happened to glance at today. And he said, you can't be a slave to two masters. You can't be a slave to both God and money. I hadn't noticed that. I mean, I've read it many, many times, and even read it in the Greek, but I hadn't noticed, but it really uses this verb that means to be a slave. And I found myself rebelling and saying, what? I don't want to be a slave to anybody. You know, we're encouraged to have a recoil against the notion of being a slave to the God, though that actually makes sense. But what I really noticed this time is that we really are slaves to our money. You know, the whole monetary system, I mean, almost, literally, I am enslaved to it. I have to pay my bills. We may think of ourselves as free, but Art's point that, you know, by defying the system, you find a level of freedom. I, by being caught up in the system, have actually found myself enslaved, and to a degree that I would rather not admit. So that's just one little thought I'd pass on. So, but now we go on to, are there any things that that people in the audience would mention from your traditions or whatever tradition of wisdom you come from, religious, secular, whatever, that you'd pass on as a resource or a thought, a principle that might guide us in these things? Yes?
I was just thinking.
Nice and loud. Now, why don't you stand up so people can hear you?
When I was hearing about Jesus, like, speaking almost in a communistic way, it reminded me of how the only time Jesus used violence was in a synagogue to drive off the money changers in the temple, and how you're saying, like, he was supporting communist kind of thought, but also that, like, it was against interest, and how our whole monetary system is based on this interest nowadays with the Federal Reserve. And how the only time Jesus actually violently drove people out was like a microcosm of our nation and its system. I was just wondering if you, Christian, if you could speak about that.
Jesus was upset about the exploitation that was going on there. I don't agree that he used violence to drive the money changers out. Check the Gospels real carefully. He drove the animals out. It does not say anywhere that he used violence against the money changers.
How did you
have them? Well, who is this Italian communist filmmaker? He was in a hotel one night. I can't think of his name. Picked up a Bible, a Gideon Bible, and he read the Gospel according to Matthew, and he says, this will make a great film. So he made a film. Not one movie professional actor in the whole film. It was all peasants. And the way he does it, in that film, he goes in and there's all these tables with the money on the tables and the tablecloth. And he just goes zip, zip, down every table and pulls off the tablecloth. And the money is all over it. And all the money changers are on the floor or on their hands and knees trying to grab the money. That was his picture of it.
Well, how about we move on to the next part then, where I really want to draw on. Yeah, go ahead, Aaron.
By the way, I'm offering good interest rates, so if you see me after the program. Just kidding. Again, I mean, the principles that we're hearing are noble and admirable and inspiring, but I keep thinking of the real world. Like, what do we do with the planet as it is now? And exorbitant interest rates, usury and so on, I think obviously is a bad thing. But if I mean, to get everyone to the point where there's universal love, where everyone loves each other, and you need help, so I'll just give you charity. And people that have, give to those that don't have. I mean, it's a great thing. Obviously, that's the way the world should be. Hopefully, that's the way the spiritual world is. Everyone's just helping and giving and so on and so forth. And yet, we have this capitalism. Because that was the topic. Actually, we've neglected capitalism. This is meant to be not only a consumerist rally, but also a capitalist rally. And one point I always stress to bring capitalism into this discussion is that I think sometimes, especially because of the Cold War, which some of you may read about in ancient history books, because of Cold War between these two economic systems, the highly controlled state economy of the Soviets or the Maoists, whatever, I think a false conception arose in America that capitalism means a free market. But actually, capitalism is something very different than just a free market. If you study ancient history, you'll find certainly in India they had free markets. People could accumulate wealth and so on. And so to me, the essence of capitalism is not merely the free market. It's the abstracting. It's the abstracting, the alienating of all kinds of gifts, God-given things in the world into numerical expressions. So just to give one simple example, I think this has a lot to do with the evil of it. Again, I think we have to separate free market from capitalism because they're very different things. Capitalism is actually an overarching ideology. It's an ideology. For example, until recently in America, there was this feverish speculation in the real estate market. I'm from California, and it was just like, well, I mean, you want to talk despicable. I mean, we're practically in California. You had to be rich just to own a home. I mean, really rich to own a home. So the problem there is when I was younger, I remember a house was a home where a family lived or some people lived. Or just, you know, where some little human group or even one person, a house was a home. But with capitalism, a house is not a home. A house is a commodity. A house is so many capitalist units. It's worth this much. So you have these big investors coming in from other countries, also from America, with huge amounts of money, investment capitalists saying, okay, I want 1,000 houses, say in California. I want maybe 300 houses in the 500 to a million range. I want 300 houses in the million to 1.5 million range, and so on. So houses aren't homes. They're numerical. They're abstracted into capitalist units. And I think somebody's really lost because a house really isn't a home anymore. Food is not... just finished this extremely long sentence. Food is no longer a staple. Food is no longer to feed a creature of God. Food is a commodity, something you bid on, like nowadays. It's just a capitalist numerical unit. So nothing is what it seems to be. Food is not food. A house is not a home. It's abstracting and alienating of all the basic realities of life into these numerical units. And the highest virtue is to accumulate capital. So there's something about restoring real things to their actual identities. Houses are really homes. Food is really food to nourish a living body and so on. Everything is not just a capitalist unit. So I think there's a whole mindset that needs to be addressed. It's not just the charging of interest. It's the alienating of real things into numerical abstractions for the purpose of greed and acquisition.
Yeah, I think that's a very smart thing. So you can say something more? No?
Okay. Well, when it's my turn.
Okay. So let's think about specifics. What can we do? I mean, I personally, just real quickly, I personally am not a communist. And I don't think, I know that there was a communist experiment in the early church, but I think that the early church as a whole probably was not communistic. So when I think about practical challenges in my own life as I struggle with this, I don't really want to overturn the current system altogether. You know, I mean, there are a lot of really good things that have come from our economic system, and then there are the bad things. And I'd really like to find a way to make things better without making things worse. And that's the challenge we face. I think that, you know, I don't think there are any of us here who would say, "Oh, let's make sure we destroy the good stuff if there's any that's come from the system." You know, we don't want to do that. But we do want to make things better. So one specific suggestion, we can go back around again, but let's each of us come up with one specific suggestion about what can we do to make things better on this issue, either at the family level or the larger level.
I'll do it quickly, but I need to first say that this is the most important question, but one that I'm uncomfortable answering because I don't want to make a bunch of rules. It's a spiritual problem. And as you said, we need to find a higher pleasure. And we find that higher pleasure, why stuff? We wouldn't even want it anymore. So it's a spiritual problem. It's recognizing the difference between our needs and our desires, between what's important and what's unimportant. Now, I'll give you a couple suggestions. There is not one, I'm going to go out on a limb, there's not one person in this room, not one, that needs to buy another piece of clothing in the next year. There is not one. I am sure I'm right. I don't know you. I'm sure you don't need to buy one more piece of clothing. How about not doing it? How about not drinking another Coke or Pepsi or soft drink? I mean, I don't do that. That feeds horrible, horrible corporations like Coca-Cola. It's not good for me. It's terribly wasteful. I guess what I want to say is take a couple steps in your life. And you don't need to follow my suggestions. Take a couple concrete, specific steps and experience the freedom that that can give.
Sure. And this one's pretty easy for those of us here in Athens. So I would say, in recognition that it is indeed a spiritual issue at the core, and also that we are, as more than one of us has said, very much divorced from for what stuff really means in our lives. To come back to a better perspective, I would suggest that we consider buying more local produce, going shopping at local stores, go to the farmer's market. It's a beautiful place. It's a lovely weather. It's just great. And to really start purchasing the stuff that we do purchase on a local level so that we have some sort of connection and some sense of connection and thought about where that stuff is coming from and what goes into it. And it's better for our local economy. It's better for us than our health and everything else. So. And it's easy to do here in Athens.
That's good advice. For myself, I see, as I got into Buddhism, I was getting out of politics. And I found myself angry over the way politics were going in this country. Similarly, I can get angry over the subject here tonight. There's just an endless list of things to get angry over. I'm good at it. I can get plenty angry. I share something personal. The thing that shook me was a political rally at someone's home, and we were going to discuss politics, and in the course of the evening, there was a picture of George Bush's head passed into a pinata, and that was given to the kids to beat with sticks, and it really got a lot of laughs, and it absolutely repelled me, and when I saw that, I was thinking about the message that's being given to these kids, and it's when I just had to stop. Like, everything is about your team, my team, us and them. Are they trying to get in my house? Did I leave it locked? I don't like the way he, she dresses. All of this separation, and I can't stand that party. And so the practical thing for me, and the thing that I'm trying to remind myself to do, and my advice would be to meditate. To just stop. Just take 5 minutes. Just stop. And if it's your way, then pray. Call it prayer. But just stop. And get off the spinning wheel for long enough to sort of figure out what might be important. All of these things that are advised are very important, very good moves to make. But at least for me, I would say, don't make any moves. Just stop. And then see what comes to you.
I was actually inspired by something that you said, and of course what you've all said. I mean, I like the idea of stopping too. As you said, ever since you were a child, you loved God and wanted to cultivate virtues. So,
not a very bad job, by the way. But yes,
I was going to talk about that also, but I think we can all recognize ourselves as spiritual beings. There's this great statement I guess because I tend to be a little intellectual, I kind of think like we can get our mind in the right place or think properly. It was one of the Buddhist things, you know, right thinking. That those who are whose primary energy in life themselves or consciousness is passion, they see the differences as fundamental. This person is a different color than that person. That's a male, that's a female. You're from this country, you're not from my country. Or not only sexism, racism, what about speciesism? That because this soul is in a different species, we can butcher it, we can do anything to it. So it's this whole thing that because a living thing, a creature of God, a living soul, is somehow in a different kind of body, whether it's different race, different gender, whether it's different species, that because someone is different, they have no rights. They've lost all rights because they're different from me. And the earth. I mean, so it's also an interesting question. Are we going to save the earth now just to save our own necks? In other words, is it ultimately because it's in our rational self-interest, so we'll do the right thing? Can we go beyond that and do the right thing because it is the right thing? Of course, that's what Kant talked about. So if we could see ourselves, if we could see all what one philosopher called biocentrism, and see that every living thing is divine, because life is divine. Consciousness, every conscious thing actually is part of God. And see the earth as an organism, which is a gift of God, and try to pursue our own spiritual life, whatever that means for us, so that we have, as we were saying, that higher taste. Because the reality of the world on the ground is that unless people outgrow selfishness, they will be selfish. Try taking a kid's toys away. Try reasoning with the child. Unless we actually experience something more satisfying, more inspiring, we will return to selfishness again and again. It's like a field of gravity. That's like, in that sense, materialism is like a black hole that doesn't let anything escape selfishness. Again and again, the gravity of our animal instincts will pull us back to selfishness unless we actually get beyond this gravitational field through higher consciousness, meditation, or loving God, or whatever. So I think we can recognize that in our own lives and become models, examples, and try to understand the truth as best we can and pursue that. So we see our life as a mission. Every one of us has a mission in life. I mean, you have to find out what it is, but everyone is born with a mission. Otherwise, to live our lives without a mission, like, hey, I'm just trying to have a good time. So if each one of us could somehow understand our own lives as a mission to cultivate virtue, to help other people, to find the highest truth, however we can understand that, and I think the rest will start to fall into place.
One quick suggestion that actually came from a couple of things Tom said. When our kids were little, they're grown now, but when our kids were little, I was really concerned that I didn't want to poison the way they looked at the world. I didn't want them to get caught up in dumb stuff. And I knew from the time that I was a child that I was easily addictable to television. You mentioned TV. And so when Barb and I got married, I said, let's make this a deal, no TV. She said, you're nuts. I said, I don't care, no TV. And we didn't have a TV the whole time our kids were growing up. We didn't get a TV until they were in high school, and I wish we hadn't then. But what I found was that it left time. It left quiet in the house. It left quiet for thinking. Our kids weren't afraid of silence. You know, they could just sit and think. And we read stories, and we'd sit down and sing songs. We talked. We went for walks, especially for those of you who have little children or will have little children, I would really, really strongly recommend that you not have a television. I think it's an amazing possibility.
My wife and I have been married for 25 years. We've never had a television set.
How about you guys? Suggestions, yeah.
First, you have a TV set.
No, I don't have a TV. But today was the first day that I rode my bike to work, worked 8 hours, rode my bike home, rode my bike to get here.
Good.
And I'm riding my bike home tonight. I sell my car, so I encourage everyone I come across to ride bikes.
That's what I want. Yeah, and I would, and I wish that our communities could get behind bike riding and make for safe streets so that we could ride without worry of being run over.
I'm excited for the bike path extension. It's going towards my house.
Where is it going? What is it?
What's that?
Where is the extension?
Toward it'll be at Dow Lake Dam.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
Instead of asking a question, instead of giving a suggestion, can I ask a question?
Sure.
For all of you?
Yeah, we wouldn't answer, but
okay. Fair enough. I know that in many of the holy texts, it advocates simplicity, but then through interpretations of those, like I know in the Talmud, it suggests that instead of you're supposed to give your tithe, but then it has a maximum on 20%, so you don't overgive. And then I was thinking of the Protestant work ethic. And I'm thinking about how a lot of people believe that if you work hard enough, then God will favor you and then give you more things, and then having things will prove that you're in God's favor. And so, since that's the way a lot of people believe, how do you balance those things with what the actual holy texts say? Or do you just completely brush aside like rabbinical interpretation and everything? I don't know.
That's a very good question. That is, let me see if I can capture your question. Let me see if I've got it. As a tradition goes on, generations, centuries pass, some of the things that lie at the very core of that faith may prove so challenging that people say, yeah, I know it says that, but really?
Yeah.
And they start letting themselves off the hook. And how do we as members of tradition deal with our own traditions when the people within our tradition say, not so much?
Exactly.
Well, as far as overgiving, I've been very actively working with religious communities for actually since I was 20. So like at least 15 years. And my experience is that it's actually common that people, I mean, if you study the sociology of religious conversion experiences and the psychology of it, people that have those experiences tend to go through a few years where they're very zealous and very idealistic, and sometimes they can actually put their families to hardship unreasonably, like they want to give everything. And I've seen so many cases, I mean hundreds of cases, where people go through that very zealous phase, they give a lot, and then later they become bitter and angry because they kind of, you know, they cooled off religiously, and they realized that their life is kind of economically ruined, and they gave everything to some... And so I think that some of these things you find in texts or commentaries are based on a lot of practical life experience. And then the other one you mentioned was overgiving. There was another one. It was...
And then the Protestant work ethic and how God maybe favors people by giving them things. And how
Weber analyzed that, of course. And I mean, there's a very strong tendency to associate wealth and power with God's mercy, because God is the source of everything, so God gave me more wealth and more power than you, because it's almost like a child saying that, mommy loves me more than you because she gave me more than she gave you. And so it has to be balanced by, again, what happens, if I can say very quickly, if you study, for example, the history of monasticism, what you find is that it's this constant cycle where some people are really like very austere and very devoted, and we don't want material things, we just want to, you know, be really good people and devout. And other people in society think, oh my God, these people are just so sincere and so spiritual, let's help them, like, let's bring them food, let's bring them gifts and everything. And they really inspire society. And then gradually they become endowed. And what happens is, they become so endowed, they become corrupted. And then, eventually, there's another reform movement. Let's get back to basics, get back to our basic piety and devotion. And then they do get back to their real devotion and piety, and that impresses society so much, they start to get endowed again. And as far as I can see, there's these boom-bust cycles, these spiritual boom-bust cycles, throughout history in all religions that I've ever studied. And it seems like the best we can do is really just sort of fight for what we know to be the real spiritual thing, and And also one last point is that when you find yourself in a certain society, like say in America now, where people are so addicted, it seems to me austerity or sacrifice is a function of what you're used to. Because if you grew up used to a certain standard of comfort, and then you have to say reduce that 20%, you feel it. So what an American, say middle class Americans, really austerity might be in another country an opulent life. And so that sometimes religious leaders have to deal with people's psychological condition. You can't push people to the breaking point. I actually finished on time.
You did.
What did I win?
I'm going to give you one of these times. Art, you must have an opinion about that.
Well, to answer your question, I think we need to go back to the texts and re-examine them. And I think that will be one of the sources for renewal. Those texts are really important. They give us a perspective different than our modern perspective.
And if I might add to that, I completely agree. I completely agree that the core of it is to go back to the texts, to re-examine the texts and reapply them. And unfortunately, that's not happening quite so much here within Islam, within North America. It's much more active in Europe. But the people themselves are ignorant of the texts. They're ignorant of what's going on with the re-examining. So I think also we really need a revival among the people of a desire to go back and learn their own texts again. They think they know. We all think, I think I know. I don't know. The more I know, the more I know I don't really know anything at all. And I do truly mean that, but ignorance.
I think I've got to mention the possibility of no God. I think I've got to at least bring up that possibility as a thought. And that is regards the Protestant work ethic as you described it. If I work hard enough, God will give me this stuff. And from my point of view, if you work that way, you're going to get stuff. I mean, you made it, right? You sell the thing, you get the pay. And that if we become attached to that, and if we're trying really hard to get that, that's what we're going to get. And that life is short, so some of the thoughts that would stop you from going that way would include the fact that you're real lucky to have this chance to do something better right now, and it's not going to last long. And so if you've chosen to spend it trying to get that stuff, at the end of it, that's what you've got. And I don't see it as a punishment or a prize or in any way a higher being giving me something. I think it's all cause and effect, and the way I spend my time is what I will get. And in that way, I suppose it's a selfish view. But a good selfish view is really dedicated to other people. That's the best way to spend your time.
And I'd say that I don't want to presuppose that the more ancient the text, the more correct it is necessarily. Mm-hmm. Because actually some of the Protestant assumptions would be based on a text probably misread, I'd think. But that is, we need to determine to try to do, I think, as individuals, what's really true, and we weigh it in the balances. We just, it's ultimately what we have to do. And I think it got me. If we really decide that there's something in an ancient text that we say, I just really can't do that. I mean, certain texts in Joshua, for example, about conquering enemies and wiping them all out, men, women, and children. I'm not going to do that, even if the text says that. I think that's wrong. No. So I don't want to just go back to the text. But if we find that our tradition is saying, oh, this whole business of being good isn't so hard. You don't have to be very different. That seems to me to be, sort of like Tom's saying that, we really want to strive to spend our lives the best way we can, to try to get what's right. So, yeah. Other questions? There's another hand back there. Win one. Yeah.
Well, I just have an idea. Mm-hmm. What about if you think when you get more money, more power, it's more a test for you to see what you can do with it. When you have a lot of money in here, they will ask you where you got it from, where you can spend it for. And the same thing, when you work hard, you get, normally when you have a good day, like luck with it, you will get a lot of benefit with it. So now, I know that we got to Islam, there's a sentence the Quran says, people who think when you get, or people who, with, I will translate now the way I can, it's not the right, effective translation. People who think that you get a lot of money, that will love you, and people who are insulted because they don't have enough money, it doesn't work that way. You have to look otherwise. If you have the money and you got more tempted to use it in the wrong way, you will get asked later on why you did that, and you will get perhaps whatever, get benefits or punished, and otherwise as well. So always think otherwise, just to spend your money the way how you can use it for yourself, and never above your level. So you still have to think, never be like jealous. He got a car, he got a house, I didn't. Always think, do I need them? Do I need all of this stuff? Like, do I need more than one or two or 40 clothes for 1 year? This is a good question. I mean, I know that this is in the psychology of the person or the human being, always want to have more. He will never stop, even Bill from the minute. He always want to have more. It's just my idea to say, answer the question of the
Yeah.
I was thinking some of what the panel was saying earlier about value, and what the young lady was saying about work ethic. And I come from a working class background. I've been working one way or another in my own money since I was 13. I'm 50 now, but I don't look at it. My point is, I think that one of the things that I learned early on was that a person should give an honest day's work for an honest day's pay. I mean, that's fair. It's fair for you, it's fair for whoever you're working for. And you may invariably run into some problems when someone else is putting a numerical value on what they think is the pay versus what you're giving up. But a person ought to be able to go home at night and feel they've given enough to be paid equitably. And we get into issues, I think, in society when people are paid less than what they think they're worth. And we get into issues when we see people getting paid more than we may think they're worth. And you think of car manufacturers with union members on strike because they don't want to make less than $18 an hour, so our auto industries are in trouble, on and on and on. And so how do we come to some equitable solution? I think it's an awful far distance down the road, but I would like to think that perhaps a solution would be if any of us, like myself right now, might find yourself in a position of managing at your job. Maybe you'll have responsibilities for hiring someone or training someone. One way we might be able to make a difference is if we try to share some value that we think has some meat on its bones, a concept of an honest day's work. As a student manager on this campus, I hire out student employees. You invariably run across someone who maybe this is the first job they've ever had. They may not have a concept of value for what they're doing. It's a paycheck for your pizza on the weekend, maybe. They don't need that money to live, maybe, but they were told they should have a job. That could be a problem employee if you let it be, or perhaps you could try to share or instill or grow some value in a young person. Or if it's further down the line and you have a more responsible position and maybe you're in charge of cost control for your company, maybe you could push the envelope a little bit and think for ways to be more efficient.
I'd really like to second that. I think that's a really good thought, that there's lots of ways that are not enormous and heroic, but you're just in the daily business of business and you get a chance to just shove it that way a little bit to try to help somebody out. Those opportunities come up a lot.
I think you see that in practice, or the lack therein, every day. And so I think one of the things we could all do is perhaps take a wee bit of responsibility in that regard and try in our day-to-day lives to just push a little bit in that positive direction, that right direction, whether it's maybe teaching someone a value that they may not know is theirs to grasp, or maybe correct something that you think is wasteful in your space, personal space, or on your job that can save you a few bucks or maybe your company hundreds of thousands of dollars, who knows? Speak of the wastefulness of this building. Perhaps there'd been a dialogue they could have come with an alternative way to spruce up the campus without wasting so much energy. So I think in the workplace and in wherever you spend your time, just push a little bit without, you know, don't break things, just push a little bit. It might help.
Yeah. Dan, stand up, why don't you?
Okay. Yeah, this has been really, really good for me to be here. I think a couple of the tendencies I'm hearing is one, and I found this very true in my life as I seek to live a life of poverty, is to not make hard passing rules for your friend or for others, to live your convictions out. And that comes from spending time in solitude. And also, I think, spending time in faith communities with people that have experience, people that have wisdom, and checking that against that. And I think a third thing is super important, and I realized this as a student, was spending time interacting with people outside of your maybe class structure, maybe your ethnic structure, whatever. Spending time with people that we have grown up with seeing as the other, but once we spend time with them, spending time with the poor, spending time with international students, you know, any of these structures that we have built, we kind of break those walls down and maybe realize errors in our ways of being part of the consumerist and capitalist structure. I think my own experience, I think it's been a huge part for me to spend time with people that are aren't nearly as taken with consumerism as I have been growing up to be, and seeing the value and freedom that they find in life through that. So that's kind of a challenge, I guess, to find pockets or find communities of people to that live in different ways and to be challenged personally by interacting with.
Yeah.
Hi. Well, first of all, I'd like to wish everyone a happy Beltane, because that's today. But if I may represent the Druid community, which I really can't because it's such a hodgepodge of beliefs, but one thing that comes to mind after what you said and after this gentleman said, there was a movement a little while ago for practicing Druids to seclude themselves, like either in the communes, to follow the ways of like living with nature, living beside nature, living a communistic life of simplicity. And while that was good for them, recently a number of the Arch Druids, just different people in the organizations, have almost had a call to arms, I guess. So like my suggestion is their suggestion, which is not to seek out the grove, so to speak, off in seclusion, but to create your own grove in the everyday life. So while there is a time and place for like monastic living or seclusion, I guess what I'm trying to get at is today we don't really have that luxury, if you could call it that. By all means, you should stop and meditate and think and take that time for yourself. But there's been a great call to arms amongst the Druid community to take action as well. Not violently, as some of them have, and we've denounced them. but to be out in your community, to be active, to be like a good manager, to change things, like Gandhi said, be the change you want to see. So I guess that's kind of like the Druid perspective of times are changing, so we have to change with them and to live a better life and to be an example for others. Because I know on campus it's especially hard to live the way I lived, substance-free and simple and active at the same time with all of this going on around me. But I do it anyway. And I'm going to be a substance-free RA to prove that you can do it and lead a better life and have an excellent life. I had a great time. But I'm trying to prove that that is a good way to live in this modern world.
Yeah. Another hand? Did I see another hand?
Yeah, I'll see some. I just want to emphasize the this idea of how important community is. A lot of people have touched on that we need to, you know, come together. And there's just some interesting points, like, you know, growing up and going through the public education system here in America, I think we are taught that, you know, materialism, you know, that's the sign of success when you get more things, you know. So these third world nations are actually unfortunate, and if we're pious, we want to try to help them out by giving them stuff. But I think an argument can be made that, you know, the more, you know, the richer a nation is materially, in a way, it betrays the fact that they're actually unhappy and not fulfilled within, like, family, social circles, because you naturally have to start going towards materialism if you're not happy inside and you're not psychologically and socially satisfied. There was a study, I can't remember, Boaz, I don't know if you remember, like, that study that some university did on trying to find the happiest people in the world. Do you know, do you remember what?
It was the poorest country, it turned out.
It was Bangladesh. They found, and I don't remember what the criteria was. You know, it was just like genuinely happy faces, all this.
And which is the poorest country.
And it ended up being the poorest country. It was Bangladesh. And I think that's, you know, that's an important point. And conversely, I heard a statistic that France, you know, representing the Western world, has the highest level of statistically or clinically depressed people. I saw where almost a third of people in France are clinically depressed. And you think about how much antidepressants people in the Western world take. And I think that's an interesting, trend to see that, like, you know, it's kind of backwards what we've been taught. It's actually, you know, this materialism is a kind of a sign of like not being happy. And you look at, you know, countries like South America and Asia, we think maybe, oh, they can't get it together, but really, you know, they have extended families, and really culturally they're much more satisfied, so they don't need to go after all these other things. And I think that's a point worth considering, you know, as Americans.
Could I just comment on that?
Go for it.
I be the gadfly here. And that is, I agree with what you said, definitely. But at the same time, just my patriotic spirit here. Because I spent actually a lot of my life in third world countries, especially in Latin America, in many, many countries there for many years. And I think if I'm not going to defend capitalism or consumerism or materialism or American go, obsessive materialism. But if there's anything good here,